Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Tipper Gore's long star-crossed lover, Rick Hess.
Hey, baby. How you doing?
Man, I just heard that news, and I have to say, I'm really sad about it.
I'm gonna, you know, I wonder if Al was hiking the Appalachian Trail, or what?
Boom. I don't know.
I'm disheartened. They always seem like a very nice couple. Remember that kiss at the 2000 convention?
Mm-hmm.
That was a serious kiss.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that kind of stuff after being married a couple decades, usually, as best I can tell.
I know.
You know, this depresses me so much, I'm going to Tbilisi.
You know what I bet it was? You know, Al Gore became a Hollywood star.
That's true.
And, I mean, that is like the kiss of death on a marriage. So, Rick, I understand you're not going to be around for a while. Our listeners are going to miss you during this summer.
Well, I'm going to miss them.
Yeah? Where are you heading? You want to tell them real quick?
So, I'm going to Tbilisi, Republic of Georgia, through pretty much the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jolene's birthday is this month, so she and I are going to do a little bit of time in Prague and Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm back, and I spent a week in Houston teaching at Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm teach a week at UPenn.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then, boy.
So what is this, Rick? You figure you've so much completed your mission of fixing American education that you've decided to go take on a whole other country.
Yeah. It's well, you know, I'm always so kind of practical and useful over here that I thought I ought to go share that kind of, you know, concrete problem-solving skills elsewhere.
All right. Well, hey, we do have a lot to cover today then. On your last show for a while, and of course, you know, Andy Smerick is off to New Jersey soon, so clearly there's going to be some changes here at the Gadfly Show. Okay, let's get started, Janie, with Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. Question one. Race to the top, round two is over. Did we get $4 billion worth of reform?
No.
I'd say maybe $2
billion. And to be fair, remember, this was the $4 billion that was going to make the other $100 billion worth it. So the question is really, given how much weight they placed on this slender reed, did we get $100 billion worth of reform? And I'd say no.
All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, the article this week by the New York Times by Sam Dillon, you know, playing up all the changes that were made at the state level. Let's see, we got some states raising their charter school caps, right? We've got some interesting teacher evaluation legislation in a couple of places. Probably strongest was in Colorado, but something interesting in New York. A couple of places got rid of their data firewall. What else we got?
I think was pretty much the exhaustive list.
Is that pretty much it?
So, you know, so I mean, I'd go $50 million each for the charter school cap bumps.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go 75. I'll go 75 million for Steiner's, you know, tenure adjustment in New York. I'll go $200 million for what Mike Johnson pulled off in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And then on the firewalls, I'll go $60 million a pop.
Yeah, yeah.
So we might have got, you know, what, $450-500 million worth of reform?
Well, those charter caps, you might go a little bit higher, but
$700 million.
All right, now that
and that's a lot of money to bump a charter cap. I gotta
all right, say that's a lot of money, but you gotta say, I mean, Arne Duncan certainly tried his hardest. I mean, it wasn't like for lack of trying or for lack of effort. So what do we learn from this? That this is just the maximum amount of leverage the federal government can have?
No. I mean, so one thing I think we learned absolutely is that the feds have limited authority. I mean, you're right. I mean, they still got more movement than many might have expected at the beginning of this thing.
Right.
Two, it depends the kinds of a movement you're pushing for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot more movement, I think, that hasn't gotten attention is all of the jargon-laden promises that states made around the vast majority of the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And there they got lots of movement, but those aren't going to add up to anything.
Right.
If they had focused more of their energy and more of the money on the things that Sam Dillon was writing about,
mm-hmm,
and the stuff that might stick, I think we would have probably seen more traction.
Okay. Topic number two.
Final drafts of the Common Core standards are out. Now, what are the next big steps?
All right. So, Rick, we're going to see a lot of interesting action this summer. Of course, all the race to the top states had to more or less promise to adopt these things by August 2nd, for better or for worse. So you're going to see a lot of activity at the state level in those kinds of adoption things. And some other states will sign on as well. So it, you know, could be by the end of the summer, maybe we have 30 states or so signing on, which is huge. I mean, nobody ever would have thought we'd be at this place even a year ago. But of course, that's just the beginning. Next come assessments. And then this whole question of what does it mean to implement standards? I mean, it could be as simple as, well, you've got to build some curricular resources, or you could start adding lists that basically say, well, you've got to use these standards at the heart of a complete system overhaul from soup to nuts. I mean, so what do you think are the essential things? I mean, so for example, all right, look at Massachusetts, right? They have great standards and they seem to implement them in a way that got some bang. They got some boost, some big jumps.
That's right. In Massachusetts, right, you go back to 93 school reform, the standards were part and parcel of what the strategy. I mean, what's interesting here is, and this is actually why your question is such a tough one, is what we've got here is you're adopting standards in states that have already built systems in which accountability and teacher preparation and evaluation, professional development, all these things were already flowing. And when these states signed up for the Common Core, they made no implicit or explicit promises that the rest of this stuff would change. So, I mean, you got to move all of it. You got to move how you train people. You got to move the textbooks you acquire. You got to change the assessments you utilize. You got to change your accountability frameworks. And what's going to be real interesting in some of these 30 states, if we see the governor's flip come November, to folks who, you know, say, hey, wait a minute, we want off the Common Core train, it'll be interesting to see whether the department then starts going into clawback mode as promised.
Well, and then there's, of course, the fiscal situation. I mean, all those things you mentioned cost money, and there's no money. So how is that going to play out? All right, topic number three.
The D.C. public schools are looking to reintegrate some special education students into their schools. Many parents aren't happy, but the move will save millions. What is in the best interest of the public?
Moving these kids back to public schools where, look, we don't have all the money in the world. If we had all the money in the world, then every family ought to get whatever it wanted for its kids, but we don't. And so the vast majority of kids go to schools and we say, given how much money we have, we're going to do the best we can by you. We only aggravate the inequities for those other kids, for the other 80%, when we tell 20% of the kids, you get all the money you want, and the rest of the kids, we're going to spend whatever's left. Look, you know, the fact that a child's been identified with special needs doesn't give that family a right to draw a blank check before any other children in that community are served.
Well, but it does give them a right. I mean, isn't that the policy?
That's exactly what the current policy is.
I mean, this is the problem, is that we have given certain kids rights that other kids don't have. And that, you know, that started out of a sense of compassion, and it's understandable. We say, look, we don't want these bad old days when kids with handicaps were excluded from the public schools or put in corners and ignored. And so access is important, and providing services is important. But we don't have a framework in IDEA where cost efficiency or effectiveness can be considered. And so as a result, we've had this crazy system where, you know, the D.C. public schools are spending $100,000 to send D.C. kids all over the country, basically, to private schools that cost a fortune. And as a result, there's less for the other kids. So, you know, Michelle Reed comes in and says, look, I'm going to fix the special education system in D.C. so that we can meet our legal obligations and provide decent services to these kids. And we want you to come back. And lo and behold, not all the parents are happy with that.
Shocking. Good for Michelle, though. I mean, parents, I'm all in favor of choice, but I'm not in favor of saying that your choice is whether you want everybody else to spend $60,000 a year on your kid. If we're going to spend $20,000 a year on your kid, like D.C. spends, give or take on average, for these students, and you'd rather have those dollars spent in a private placement, I'm fine with that. But I'm not fine with your kid getting an extra $40,000 at the expense of that child over there.
Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Whew, serious, wonky, nuanced. Love it, Rick.
Well, there you go, baby.
I love it. But what our listeners love is Amber's Research Minute. You know, Amber, I should say, you know, even the writers for the show, in other words, Mickey, seems to think that you do such a better job. But in our little script that we have, which is not much of a script, when Rick and I are bantering, you know, it says here that we're supposed to have banter, small talk, offensive jokes. When it comes time for your research minute, it just says, great, concise summary of a research study.
Wow.
I mean, Rick, it's pretty clear.
So you guys can let me
how
know
how our own staff feel about
whether
it.
It's
well, you
great
know, now what I'm
concise.
Noticing here, now that I'm actually looking for this script for the first time in months, Stafford is bracket hilarious, incisive analysis of current reform, close bracket. I got to say, I thought we agreed that we haven't actually seen a reform analyzed in calendar 2010.
Fair enough. Okay, Amber.
I hope I bring it. All right.
Yeah, bring it today.
Bring it.
Bring
what
it,
what you got for us?
All right. We have a new report out by the Texas Schools Project that asks whether weighting AP courses enhances the likelihood that students will take them to improve their GPA. As most folks are aware, we've seen a big rise in the number of students taking AP courses. So the question here is grade weighting to blame? Researchers examined survey data and course-taking patterns for individual students in roughly 800 high schools in Texas. They found that only 2.5% of schools did not weight AP courses. The most common weighting was 10%, typically 10 points on a 100-point scale. In short, researchers found that grade weighting does not increase AP course-taking in math, science, and English. There was a small increase in AP social studies courses when it came to Hispanic, Black, and white students who are not low income. But again, the differences were small and hard to make sense of. Researchers conclude that other rewards to AP course taking, including earning college credit and the advantages in the college admission process, are strong enough to induce participation without the additional incentive of grade weighting.
Okay, so let me ask the first basic question. So are we talking about here, like, when you get a GPA, if you get an A in your AP class, you get a 4.5 instead of a 4.0?
Yes, so we're talking about, so in other words, if you've got, you know, kids who take easy courses, you know, and they get straight A's, and then get the kids who take the AP courses and they get straight A's, then you're obviously going to give the kid who take the AP courses, a higher.
What did you think we were talking about?
I just want to make sure. I that's what I thought, but I got confused by the whole 10% thing. I started thinking, I didn't know what it was. It was easier to get an A. I don't know what it was. All right. I'm just glad.
That clears everything up for me. It means. Right. So there it is.
All right. That's kind of an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we do know from a Fordham study of AP teachers that the teachers are reporting that their belief that kids are taking these classes for utilitarian reasons, mostly being to get college credit.
That's right. Make their applications look better. Yeah. That sort of thing.
But I got to say, I mean, even if you don't have the grade point bonus, that doesn't negate that thing, right? Colleges are still saying, ooh, you took 7 or 8 AP classes.
Right.
Admissions counselors are still going to be able to take that to the table and say, invite, you know, let's admit, you know, Jimmy. He's taking APs.
One last question here. So, you know, I think the whole utilitarian thing is interesting because right now we're at this demographic bulge where we have the largest senior class in history. Mm-hmm. And it's going to start going down again for a while. And so I'll be curious to see. I mean, all this pressure we have about kids getting to college and they're taking all these AP classes, I wonder if that will subside some as the baby boom echo kids are kind of out of the system and into college. And there's just fewer kids around competing for those same slots.
Hmm. What we need another guest on this show who's a member of the millennials to speak truth to us about these things.
Well, guess what? We have one coming up to rate that.
Whoa!
But before that, Amber, what are we going to listen to?
So this
to
is
today?
A stretch. Sometimes it's a stretch.
Oh, but and by the way, is it a repeat again?
No, but we have not had, or correct me if I'm wrong, have we had Alanis Morissette on the Research Minute?
I think we did.
I don't think we had. I remember
some angry, screechy song.
Really?
Alanis is awesome.
This was to fit her in. I didn't think we had her. So since we're hoping these kids learn, we have You Learn by Miss Morissette.
You know, Alanis is going to call in. She's going to be like, you know, there's only one person who gets called Miss Morissette, and that's my mother. Oh. Amber, please call me Alanis. You know what we haven't used yet? We haven't used Whitney Houston's I Believe the Children Are Our Future. Whatever the name of that is.
I have to say, You Learn as a song, I mean, that's pretty wide. That's pretty much slot that into any topic here. You mean there wasn't a song about AP participation?
I thought that would have been better for direct instruction story, too. You good. Learn. She learns. You he learn. Learns. They learn.
All right. Well, please give it up for Research Assistant Janie and Rate That Reform. Welcome back to the show, Janie.
Thanks.
Stafford is out sick. She's been overworking.
But before we get to Rate That Reform, you're a millennial, aren't you?
In what sense?
I don't know. You're like one of those millennial people.
Generationally.
Sure.
Yeah. So what's the answer to our inquiry before?
What?
What's the question?
Forget. I remember we were talking about millennials and stuff.
Wait, how... You're too old to have Alzheimer's.
Well, we were just talking something about. Remember, we wanted to ask a millennial. There was some question that had come up.
Oh, but there wasn't a question. You just mentioned something about millennials. I mean, it was a non sequitur. I said that right now it's really hard to get into college because there's so many kids that are like, you know, junior, senior year of high school. That's going to start to subside.
Well, I said we ought to ask a millennial if it feels like it's very hard to get into college.
Was it hard to get into college, Janie, when you were going through?
It seemed like it was getting harder every year. You know, it was still a little bit, yeah. a little while ago.
Was it hard
for me,
to find employment at Fordham?
No.
We actually, Janie, it was a long story, but we saw her in our lobby downstairs.
Yeah, you know. I accidentally took the wrong elevator.
She was trying to get to the eye care place. As an
right, she had written two reports before anybody realized she was in the wrong office.
But damn, she's good. All right, Janie, what reform are we rating?
We're rating a reform from one of the Oxford colleges about its application essay.
What?
What?
It's not K-12. It's not even in America, for God's sake.
But it's so interesting.
Hello. You think this is a good time for you to show some cultural sensitivities when you're on your way to the Republic of Georgia.
Do you think,
Janie,
you think USAID plays these tapes as part of the screening process?
Well, you better hope not, but they don't go back to the archives. Oops. Okay. Janie.
An age-old Oxford tradition has come to an end. All Souls College, a constituent college of the University of Oxford, which is basically the equivalent of an Oxford graduate school, has decided to stop administering its world-famous one-word admissions exam. Every year since 1932, and sporadically before then, the school's rigorous two-day, 12-hour admissions test has included an essay assignment with a single-word prompt. In 3 hours, students are expected to expound on the word in order to demonstrate intellectual agility. Past words have included innocence, mercy, harmony, charity, reproduction, etc. The assignment, literally a single word written on a blank sheet of paper, is daunting for many. But the college recently decided to get rid of the essay. The head of the college remarked that the essay has not proved to be a very valuable way of providing insights into the merit of candidates. More bluntly, historian Robin Briggs described the essay as an exercise in showmanship to avoid answering the question. Both admit that the essay is the applicant's chance to sound brilliant by displaying his knowledge of classic philosophers and heavy tomes, whether or not they're actually related to the subject. As such, the unique essay is no more. Personally, I think it is a shame that the college is getting rid of its one-word exam. You know, it may be all about making something sound good rather than actually displaying knowledge of, you know, a body of work, but I don't think that ridding the application of this one or the application of this one essay solves the problem. It seems a little misguided to me, particularly because the essay questions that remain are equally obscure and arguably more bizarre and will not lend themselves to a more relevant, concrete response than a single-word essay. For example, do the innocent have nothing to fear?
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
How many people should there be? And my personal favorite from the article, does the moral character of an orgy change when participants wear Nazi uniforms?
Yes.
So it seems to me that...
The answer is yes.
Exactly.
Next question.
In this case, scholars will display showmanship and just kind of, you know, rambling musings no matter what the prompt. And in a way, you know, that is kind of a measure of a scholar's ability to weave together an argument and argue persuasively. So as I see it, the college is losing something unique but not benefiting from the loss by getting rid of this essay. So I give it a C.
Do the innocent have nothing to fear?
I'll have to get back to you with that. With
the
3 hour essay.
The answer is yes.
They have nothing to fear?
They have nothing to fear.
The innocent.
They're innocent.
Yeah.
I see. But fear itself.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of like this. I was thinking of that for Part of the Gadfly, we could try this format.
Just one word. Just throw something out there.
We could just say...
Texas.
Duncan. Texas is good. What else? What would work?
Donut.
Donut. Billions. Yeah, see, one word is tough.
It is
tough.
You're
right. You're right. I mean, I could use like three words maybe. Would
carburetor.
Okay. Carburetor. Georgia.
Georgia.
Sensitive.
State or the country.
All right. Well, I have to say, Janie, you know, not to jump on Rick's bandwagon here, but it is true that we are struggling to find reforms of the K-12 system in the United States.
Well, so many of the reforms are very bland.
Okay. Well, that is all the time we have for today. And Rick is not going to be with us for a while. We're going to miss you. Aww. Maybe you can call in from Georgia and tell us how things are going over
Maybe
there.
I'll send an email. Y'all can read it.
Ah, that would be nice.
It'll be like a dispatch.
We could Skype, you know.
That would be the first time I skipped. Although I did get an iPad yesterday.
No, did you?
I did. I was like, what the heck, for the trip. Now I'm going to have like 30 books with me. I'm so excited.
That's very exciting.
Because otherwise, lugging books around Europe is always a mess.
Well, then Rick can listen to the podcast on his iPad as well as read our blog at Flypaper.
Aww.
You can. But until then.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.